Well, good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of USIP, the Jennings Randolph Fellowship Program in particular, I'd like to welcome you all this afternoon to the sixth in our 2007 Project LaPorte series. My name is Lynn Tesser. I'm a program officer in the Fellowship Program, and I'll also be serving as the moderator. I'll just mention that each spring and summer, we ask our current senior fellows and guest scholars to give public presentations on their research in progress, like the one today. And we do this for at least two reasons. First, so that we can get a good glimpse of the research that's being done. And secondly, so that our fellows and guest scholars can receive feedback on their work at, I think, a critical time, a time when they've done quite a bit of work, but yet there's still a lot left to be done. So I think it's a perfect time to hear your questions and comments, and we look forward to hearing those. So with that, it's my great pleasure to formally introduce guest scholar Soren Justin Peterson. He's been with us this year working on a project on the political consequences of humanitarian intervention. And needless to say, we're delighted to have him give a presentation today on what happens to be the International Day of UN Peacekeepers. And we're delighted that he could take time out of a very busy schedule also to give this talk. I know this week, for example, he had to endure two 18-hour flights. So my job, in addition to being moderator, will be to make sure that Soren doesn't fall asleep during his presentation or during the comments. So to say a few things about Soren before coming to USIP. He was Special Representative of the UN Secretary General and head of the UN mission in Kosovo from 2004 to 2006. Immediately prior, he was the EU Special Representative to Macedonia. And for many years before that, Soren served with the UN High Commission for Refugees, in which his most recent position was as Assistant High Commissioner in Geneva. Finally, he holds an MA from the University of Copenhagen. Now, for the media in the room, I'd like to offer our usual disclaimer, which is that Soren's views do not necessarily reflect the views of the U.S. Institute of Peace. USIP does not advocate specific policies. This event will be recorded and available on the web in about a week's time. And I'd also at this time like to formally thank Elizabeth Jones, who is Soren's research assistant, the young lady sitting out at the table outside, who's done a lot of work to make this event possible. She at present is in Georgetown University's law school. And I would like to finally make a plea to everyone to please turn off their cell phones and BlackBerries, so that we don't have any interference in our microphone system. So with that, I'll turn the floor over to Soren for about a half an hour presentation, and after that, we'll open it up for your questions and comments.
Thank you very much, Lynn. I will probably stay awake as long as I talk, but you may not if I talk for about half an hour. Furthermore, because my comments risk to be a little bit unfocused in the sense that, as Lynn mentioned, I am writing a book and I am about halfway through, and the chapters I'm writing are supposed to build up the evidence for the concluding chapter, and I think that the concluding chapter would interest you more than my very loose and preliminary comments at this stage. Let me also maybe, Lynn, just correct. I'm not writing a book about the political consequences of humanitarian intervention. I'm writing a book about the humanitarian consequences of political action, or lack of political action, slow, late political action. So I'm looking at the humanitarian consequences. It's a book that is based on my own experience over about 30 years, mostly in the humanitarian field, but also the last 5-6 years in the political field. It's about experiences, anecdotes, reflections, observations, and then leading to some lessons learned, and with all humility, some recommendations how we may be able to do better in future on the issues that I will address. So my talk as I say, is very preliminary, and what I hope is to get something back from here, from your comments and observations, so you are by now part of my research, and thank you very much for that. I will, in the book, be looking at four main operation situations that I have been personally involved in. I will be looking at the Western Balkans from 91 and right up to now, and hopefully by the time I conclude by October, November this year, I can have a concluding chapter on the independence of Kosovo as the last piece in the puzzle. In that chapter, I will be focusing on how, for many years, and certainly the first 4 or 5 years of the conflict, the humanitarian action was and became a substitute for decisive political action. I will be looking at what I consider to be the failures of the Security Council, more than 140 resolutions adopted on the Western Balkans, most of them, I would say, harmless, a few of them harmful, and a few also useful, certainly. I will be looking at the peace agreements that brought an end to the conflict. I will be looking at three Dayton 1244 Security Council resolution on Kosovo and Ohrid. And my point is that only one of the three addressed the root causes of the conflict, and that was the last one that brought to an end the very brief conflict in Macedonia. By then, it seemed we had all fortunately learned the lessons, intervened in time, stopped the conflict before it spread further, but also addressed the root causes, which in my view was very much about the grievances of the Macedonian Albanians' lack of equality and other issues in Macedonia. Dayton was a very important agreement in that it stopped the suffering, and for those of us who were working on the humanitarian side, it was absolute priority at that time to stop the suffering, but at the same time it did not address the root cause. In fact, I would even suggest that it confirmed the root causes by dividing Bosnia in two. Dayton even talked about a zone of separation, and it became then the responsibility of the implementers to try to implement what in many ways was an incomplete peace agreement. But as I say, I want to underline the top priority was to stop the human suffering, and Dayton very importantly did that. 1244 also brought to an end the conflict in Kosovo, but deferred a solution. In other words, again, did not address the root causes of the conflict, deferred the solutions, established a interim mission full of contradictions, and again, left it then up to those responsible for implementing to implement an incomplete agreement. And I personally had that experience for 2 years, and struggling with the many contradictions in 1244. We can get back to it if you are interested. I'm just sketching sort of, in very general terms, some of the issues. And then Ohrid, as I mentioned, did address the root causes. That is one of the reasons that progress has been much better in Macedonia, in fact confirmed by the fact that the EU has given candidate status to Macedonia, whereas Bosnia is still lagging far behind, and in Kosovo we are still waiting for the solution, but hopefully it is not too, it will happen very soon. On the Balkan chapter, I will talk about much of the progress that we have seen, and I will also devote quite a lot of attention to the importance of the European perspective. I think the combination of what you would call the hard power of the US and the soft power of the EU has worked extremely well in the Balkans. And a lot of the progress that we have seen, and we have seen a lot of progress, is very much due to this close collaboration between the US and the EU, and on the EU side, the very important EU perspective. On the second chapter, I'm looking at a couple of situations again that I've been deeply involved in Africa. And please bear in mind, the red thread in the book is always the same. It is the humanitarian consequences of lack of political action, fail, slow, or delay, but also successful. I mean, it should not all be negative. But in the Great Lakes, I'm looking at the in Africa, I'm looking at the situation of the Great Lakes and West Africa. What I focused on, and I have sort of concluded the first chapter on the Balkans, and I've also concluded the chapter on Africa. What I focused on is, again, the failure to act in the Great Lakes on three occasions. The International Community Security Council failure to prevent and then stop the genocide. Then secondly, the failure to intervene in the refugee camps in Zaire to separate the genocidaires, the killers, from the civilians, from women and children. And the third failure was after the hundreds of thousands have gone back, several hundreds of thousands walked the other way into the bush. Again, there were an initiative to mount an international peace operation to go and establish safe corridors to find those who were walking away and save the children and women and children and others who were held hostage by the killers. And again, the Security Council failed to act. I'm going into all the reasons and also again looking at the consequences and where we are today. And I will evidently look at the entire region where we are today, or have looked at the entire region, both in the Congo, Burundi, and Rwanda. What interests me on West Africa, and when I say West Africa, it is Liberia, Sierra Leone, Ivory Coast, and Guinea. What I'm particularly focusing on in that chapter is something that applies to most population movements, situations, that is the regional aspect. When you look at those four countries, it was obvious from the beginning that the problems were very much linked, and again, the solutions. But we as an international community, never developed a regional approach. I remember when I first started working on that situation and went down to the region, and I went very often. We considered at the time, in 97-98, Ivory Coast and to a lesser extent Guinea-Conakry as relative havens of stability. They were havens in the sense that all the refugees fleeing from Liberia and Sierra Leone at the time would find asylum in Ivory Coast and in Guinea. After a long time, far too long, the international community, or rather those with historic interest, if I can put it that way, in Sierra Leone, that is the UK, and Liberia, the US, finally intervened, stopped the conflicts and the suffering. But meanwhile, Ivory Coast and Guinea started moving in the wrong direction. So in other words, it tipped over. Today, Liberia and Sierra Leone are relatively stable, certainly in a much better position, situation than 10 years ago, but it has tipped over. Guinea-Conakry is very quickly moving towards becoming a failed state, and Ivory Coast is just hanging in there on the brink. So we rest that the relative stability we have found in Liberia and Ivory Sierra Leone will now be jeopardized by instability in the neighboring countries. Why? Because we are still not looking at this region as a region. People are moving across borders, refugees, rebels, etc. It are all interlinked. Finally, and fortunately, a lot has been invested into peace in Sierra Leone and Liberia, and I think we have a chance now of seeing those countries moving forward, but only, not only if we invest all the necessary resources, patience and time in supporting those countries, but also we look at the region as such and make sure that we move the region forward together. I don't see that happening, and therefore I am worried about the potential negative impact on the relative stability in Sierra Leone and Liberia of what's happening in the neighboring countries, and following that very closely. In a third chapter, I'm looking at what I call the forgotten crises. There are so many of them. And I have chosen four that I know a little bit about. I will, of course, be looking at why crises are forgotten. I mean, you all know it. There are many, many reasons. No strategic interests. There are no sponsors. By that, I mean no former colonial powers or others with interest in those countries. There is, for the same reason, no media interest. There is a sense that we can ignore many places because they don't really matter, which I believe in our interconnected world is a risk. We are ignoring all these crises at our peril. And certainly a couple of those I'm looking at have already been, it has already been confirmed. I will be looking at Afghanistan before 9/11. Why? Well, because at the time I was with UNHCR and we had the world's largest refugee population, more than 6 million refugees, and it was almost impossible. And I personally was very much involved and tried. It was almost impossible to mobilize international political interest in that refugee situation, not to mention financial resources. That, of course, all changed 9/11, but there is a risk that, again, we are forgetting with all the attention on Iraq. I know it's been very much discussed recently that, indeed, by moving all our focus on Iraq, we forgot Afghanistan, and it might still go wrong and go back to where we were. I will be looking at, three of the other forgotten crises, Burma. Again, I will not go into details, but I believe that hundreds of thousands of people who are the victims of the military junta and the misrule, mismanagement, and our lack of attention, our lack of interest in that situation, hundreds of thousands have been forgotten and are still forgotten. Colombia, again, I believe with the world's largest displaced population, again, although there is some interest, it is, I believe, very limited. It is very much of a bilateral, but I don't see any kind of sustained international interest and action. And again, hundreds of thousands of civilians are the victims of that conflict. And then finally, I will be looking at a conflict that is, if I should qualify forgotten crisis, I can talk about that one being completely forgotten, and that is Western Sahara. I would suggest that some of you here may not even have heard about that, but there we are talking about more than 100,000 people literally disappearing in the sand. And again, I'd like to look at why and what is happening and what does that mean for the people who are forgotten. The fourth chapter is a little bit different, where I will be looking at migration of and asylum issues. I believe that there are few issues that have received so much attention in media and in the public, and at the same time so little coordinated constructive political focus and action. I believe that issues around migration and asylum has been addressed in a very negative way, in a very defensive way, and in a very reactive way. And attention happens only if there is a major crisis. It is also issues around which, particularly in Europe, right-wing political parties have emerged and done very well. And again, I will be looking at that. I should say, however, that the former Secretary General Kofi Annan, to his credit, did try to bring that issue on the international political agenda. Global Commission on International Migration was established, I believe, in 2004 or 2003, and there was a major meeting in New York on the issue. That was an attempt on the part of the Secretary General to move that issue on the political agenda, but I still don't see it happen. And that will bring me then, these are the chapters, and then the fifth chapter will be the observations, lessons learned, conclusions, and recommendations. There are four main issues that go through the book. One is, and that is very much linked to the migration asylum issue, but also the refugee issue, that is the fundamental issue of the management of population movements. Secondly, I will be looking at political action, thirdly at humanitarian action, and fourthly, humanitarian consequences. The first one, in my view, the movement of people and how we manage the movement of people, population movements, or how we do not manage is, I believe, one of the key challenges of the 21st century. Why? Because in our interconnected, interdependent world, globalized, mass communication, etc., an increasing, ever-increasing number of people are on the move, either voluntarily or because they are forced by political circumstances, by conflicts, or by economic circumstances. And in addition, we all know that more and more people will be forced to move for environmental reasons. The independent commission that I referred to estimated that more than 200 million people today are migrants in one sense of the word or another. 200 million, that is the same as the fifth largest, most populous country on earth, Brazil. And 200 million means that the figure has doubled just in 25 years. And I would certainly suggest that it will increase rapidly and constantly. That already in itself means that we need a much, much greater focus on it. The numbers are already significant. We also know that behind those figures are the fates of individual human beings. Many of them die on the way, many of them are turned away on the border, many of them are victims of trafficking, many of them, the large majority, are living wherever they are as second-class citizens. So it is primarily a humanitarian issue, and very often a humanitarian tragedy. But it is also a major and should be a major political issue, and we all know, of course, it is increasingly seen or perceived as a major security issue. I say perceived because despite the growing numbers, the real security threats among those millions, tens, hundreds of millions, the real security threats are very, very few. But there has been a tendency recently to sort of place collective guilt on all of those moving in our attempt to catch the few who really pose security threats as such. There is a need to find a much, much better balance between what I would call state and human security. And I think we have to understand much, much better that state security is human security. There's no doubt that since 9/11, in many parts of the world, and in particular in the industrialized part of the world, state security has become the priority, and human security has often been sacrificed in the pursuit of state security, sacrificed by borders, increasingly closed borders. Walls are being built. Let me just recall that before 89, the wall in Germany was built to keep people in. Now walls are being built to keep people out, whether it is in this country here, whether it is on the West Bank, whether it is in Iraq, walls are being built to keep people out. So borders are closed, walls are being built, a lot of innocent civilians suffer collateral damage by this focus on state security, and also refugee protection, protection of people in need of asylum are also being, to say the least, compromised. Let me here recall that humanitarian conventions like the Geneva Convention, the refugee conventions of 1951 and 67, those conventions are exactly aimed at protecting the individual as a way of protecting our society. But today, I believe that we are increasingly protecting our society against the individuals in need of protection. I will also look in the same context, but as a very specific issue and problem. I will be looking at how we need to balance the right of states to protect states and their citizens versus their obligation to provide asylum and protecting to fleeing refugees. And in particular, at a problem that we have been facing, we faced it in the Great Lakes region of Africa, in West Africa, we have been facing it all over the world, that is refugee camps with mixed populations, where you have what I would call the civilians, women, children, but certainly also men, and then mixed with soldiers, rebels, gangs, or others. It was a problem, a major problem, as I say, in the 90s in the Great Lakes, but it is also a problem today. For example, most recently we see what is happening in Lebanon. All those camps for the Palestinians, I'm afraid, are all such mixed camps. But we're also seeing it in Darfur. And I saw a piece in the Washington Post last week, an interview with Jan Eliasson, who is the Secretary General's special envoy, I believe on Darfur, on Sudan, but I think on Darfur. And according to this, he expressed concern over the infiltration of weapons into the refugee camps. Quote, "There has been a radicalization inside the camps. People are trying to survive in unbearable conditions, and in some cases there are guns showing up inside the camps," he said. Quote, "The longer this conflict wax on, the more problems we face. How do we deal with tribal fighting and radicalization in the camps?" Unquote. Well, that's exactly the question we have been asking ourselves, certainly since the 90s, when we first started confronting these problems, and that we should be asking ourselves today. It is a major issue, whether it is, as I say, in the Middle East, whether it is in Darfur or in other parts of the world. We, at the time when we were confronted with the problems in the Great Lakes, we started discussing it with the peacekeeping department in New York, and we came up with the idea, which I believe is still valid, but I never hear about it again. I will certainly be looking at it in my book. That is a kind of a ladder of options, whereby you graduate your response to the level of the threat. You look at what is the threat, what is the problem, you then see whether the local authorities have the capacity to deal with it. In most situations they will not. What kind of international support you can bring into it, right from police support and right up to the ultimate international military support. Again, I believe that we are ignoring this problem, and I was slightly amused when I saw Eliasson saying, how do we deal with tribal fighting and radicalization in the camps? He is absolutely right. The problem is that we are still asking the question. We really have to look at it again, and I would suggest that we try looking at this ladder of option approach. So I said, I have another 5 minutes, huh?
Oh, fine.
That's fine. we need to manage population movements much better. And today, in my view, we are not managing at all. It only becomes a political priority if there's a crisis, and it's very ad hoc. And we respond to the consequences and in a very selective way. Also, when it comes to humanitarian interventions, they are, of course, very, very selective. And let me just add here, some of you with whom I've discussed it before will know that I always have to say here that I have a major problem with the word humanitarian intervention. The kind of interventions we have seen in Kosovo, which was very much welcome, other places, are not very humanitarian, but they are mounted for humanitarian reasons. But I'm mentioning this because I believe, and I will come back to it later, that the blurring of distinctions between what is political, what is humanitarian, what is military, has done a lot of damage, not the least to the integrity of humanitarian action, but I'll say just a few words about later. But we need to manage these movements of people both as a threat to the state and a threat to the individual, but also as opportunities. And we don't see it as opportunities as we should. And again, I will not go into details on how managing migrations really should be seen also as a way of enriching our societies. You all know about that. What I would like to see, and that's what this international initiative that Kofi Annan took aimed at, that is that the management of population movements moves much higher on the political agenda. An important part of managing it is, of course, through political action. And it needs to be addressed globally, regionally, and nationally. Globally, we know that the Security Council has, since the early 90s, recognized that violations of human rights, humanitarian crises, and flows of refugees could constitute threats to peace and security. But let us be clear here. It is not those on the move who are the threats. It is our failure to address these situations that provokes the threats. So I don't want this to be seen as if those on the move are the threats. It is our failure again to manage that are threats to peace and security in the receiving states and in the regions as such. But since the Security Council recognized that the refugee flows, humanitarian rights, human rights violations could constitute threats to peace and security, the Council as such has also judged that it could get involved in internal conflicts. A very important subject, which I believe was discussed here the other day when you looked at the book unbound, the UN bound. So today, the Security Council has the mandate. I believe in most situations we have the information, although for political reasons we very often choose to ignore the available information. And now we also have the recognized responsibility to protect. However, what we don't have, and I certainly will not have a recipe here, we most of the time don't have the will to act on the basis of the mandate, to act on the basis of the information, or even to follow through on the responsibility to protect. And what we are seeing is a regrettable selectivity on when we decide to use that mandate, when we decide to act on the basis of available information. I will be struggling with all that as I write my final chapter, but I hope to be a little bit more conclusive and a little bit more helpful than I can be now. There must, or there should rather, be a way, and I know there is not, but there should be a way to hold the Security Council, the members, accountable for failure to act in cases when the mandate is there, when the information is there. But how? The only thing I can see is a much greater role for civil society and for the media in constantly bringing these issues on the agenda and hope that eventually it will lead to action but based on my experience over the last 15 years, I must say I don't have very high hopes that it will happen, but if I have any hope, it is in civil society and in the media. Regional organizations also have an important responsibility in managing population movements. They are, of course, the most directly affected by cross-border movements. They therefore have an interest, but they also have a responsibility to manage and resolve such situations, and also a responsibility not to undermine neighbors the way that they provoke or promote movement of people. It is obvious, again, you all know it, that we have to strengthen the regional organizations. They have to play a much more important role, but we see again and again and again that they simply don't have the capacity, certainly when we move beyond Europe, they don't have the resources. When I mean the EU as a regional organization, of course, has capacity and resources, but when we move to Africa, Asia and other places, they exist. Are very often doing a very good job, but constantly constrained by lack of resources, lack of capacities, and there must be a much more focused attempt at strengthening these regional organizations. National authorities evidently also have a very important responsibility in managing the movements of populations. What I would like to see, what I haven't seen in my experience, is that we nationally look at these issues comprehensively. The responsibility are dispersed in various government departments and they never come together. They don't even talk to each other. It is foreign affairs, it is interior, it is justice, it is defense. There are sometimes attempts of some kind of ad hoc coordination, but certainly what I know a little about Europe and Scandinavia, they don't talk to each other. There is a need to look at the movement of people, migration, asylum, refugees and others, displaced persons, comprehensively, and bring to bear everything that exists in national administrations. Humanitarian organizations, of course, have a key role in the management of population movements. I am, however, concerned, and will also be focusing a lot on that, at how I believe over the last several years, in fact going back even to Kosovo in 1999, how humanitarian organizations have lost both their integrity and their voice. Why is that? Well, it is because I believe key states have very often ignore their humanitarian obligations, and why? What do you then expect other states to do if they see key states ignoring their humanitarian obligations? Moreover, we have seen, we saw it in the Balkans, we have seen it in other situations, that political bodies and also military institutions have very often what I would call hijacked humanitarian action, either as a substitute for their decisive action, but as something that fits into their strategy. That was the example, if possible, we have seen it again in Iraq and Afghanistan. And as I mentioned earlier, when political bodies and military, I can't find another expression, it is a little bit harsh in some situations, but still, hijack humanitarian actions, distinctions between political, humanitarian and the military is blurred. And in the process, the humanitarian organizations are then often perceived as the extended arm of the political operation, of the military operations. And that have provoked threats to the integrity and to the impartiality of humanitarian action, and in the process to humanitarian staff, to the security of humanitarian action staff. And I think that's very worrying. The fact that they have lost their voice, very often lost the integrity and impartiality, I think that is of concern, because we need humanitarian action. We need an impartial humanitarian action. At the same time, we all know, and I certainly know it painfully well, that humanitarian action cannot as such solve a political problem. But at the same time, exactly because we need political solutions to address humanitarian crises and problems, the humanitarian issues must be on the political agenda. Many of my friends in the humanitarian community always get very, very nervous when some of us advocate that humanitarian issues must be on the political agenda. But that is simply to push the fact that humanitarian problems require political solutions. It is not to suggest that we should politicize humanitarian action. But political bodies, and again I know I'm dreaming, but let me be allowed to dream, should not use humanitarian action as a substitute for political action. And they should take great care to respect and preserve the impartiality of humanitarian actions. And humanitarian organizations should do likewise. They should respect and understand political action. And again, we don't always do that. Finally, the book is, as I said, it's about my experiences, it's anecdotes, encounters, observations, lessons learned, recommendations. But it is also, and that is very important for me, it is also written out of respect for and a tribute to what I would call the victims of our failure to act, but also the beneficiaries of our successes. We all know, if you have been dealing with such problems, that victims of conflicts are among the strongest, among the most courageous people that we will meet. At the same time, we also know, it is a fact, unfortunately, that very often their voices are not heard. I believe they can speak on their own behalf. And I shouldn't speak on their behalf. But if I can help to have their voices heard and give them a voice of some of the many dilemmas and problems we are facing, with a view to maybe here and there promote better solutions, then I also believe with the book that I've already achieved a little bit. So these were my comments. Once again, I apologize. Very much preliminary. I am reflecting even as I talk, and I'll be reflecting and listening very carefully to you. I hope you have a lot of good ideas, so that 1.5 hour research this afternoon has not been wasted, neither for you nor for me. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Søren. Well, as you can see, this is a very ambitious project. It's a book that's being written in Danish, and we're hoping very much that it
in Scandinavian.
Okay.
I mean, three languages.
But we hope at some point it will be translated into English. I just want to also mention the event and book that Søren was referring to is Michael Matheson's book called Council Unbound. We had a book launch for it a couple months ago here, and it concerns the expansion of the UN Security Council's legal authority, so that may be of interest to some of you, published by USIP Press. So with that, I think I'll just open it up to the audience for questions and comments. I tend to like to take questions in threes, so if we can get three questions to start off with, and if you can say your name and state your affiliation, that would be great. So let's start with Dan, and then this lady here, and this lady over here.
The lady there is Patricia.
Ah, yes, okay.
Sir, we're from USIP. First of all, I think we should note that if Søren is this eloquent in English, this would be quite a book. His own name. You mentioned in passing the benefits of migration and population movements, but only in passing, and as if, you know, you wouldn't deal with this issue at all. But, you know, I have to wonder whether that's entirely wise. The costs of humanitarian action are simply staggering, is the only way to describe it. That, of course, may look very small when we get military action, but they're still quite staggering. I'm not sure the typed back in about 4 of these days, but it's in the many hundreds of millions of dollars at this point. You know, there's the degree to which I think our willingness to pay that is a willingness that arises in part out of resistance to immigration. European resistance to immigration is even greater than American resistance to immigration. So I just wonder whether this question, you know, it's not natural to think that everybody will stay in the same place all the time. That's the truth of the matter. Even if the reasons for people moving in Darfur are obviously conflictual and artificial in some respect, well, history is a history of population movements. It's not a history of people staying in the same place. So the question, it seems to me, looking at the other side of the equation and the benefits of immigration, the benefits of taking in people who are threatened elsewhere, it seems to me not to be totally irrelevant.
Thank you. Moving on.
Patricia Fagan, Georgetown University, formerly colleague of Soren, Meyer Soren, the UNHCR. It's a part question, a part comment as well, as a fellow academic now, Soren. It seems to me that you've circled around and focused on a central dilemma, which is, if I can sum it up without distorting the richness of what you said, is that humanitarian action has political roots, political consequences, and requires political action to be effective, and sometimes military action to be effective. But at the same time, you also said quite strongly that blurring the distinctions between or among humanitarian, political, and military actions are harmful. So that is that's the dilemma that faces all of us in all three areas. And I wonder if you're thinking about your concluding chapter, is it your intention to elaborate, to do a kind of taxonomy of what the humanitarian intervention is? And if so, will it include also something about the humanitarian actions themselves and how they have political consequences at times? And what the roles and mandates of the various organizations could be, should be, might be, and that would include the roles and mandates of organizations that aren't humanitarian, but nevertheless, what they do has humanitarian consequences, and they ought to be aware of it. I'm just wondering if that's part of your thinking about the final chapter. And I have to say that when this book comes out in its English translation, I'll be among the first to buy it.
Well, then I have two already.
Keep track of the orders. Great, please.
My name is Dr. Paul, and I'm with the National Supreme Court. And one of the things we are trying to accomplish is to be more efficient and effective when the state of warfare that our economists get the income provided to the history. And then what kind of security is required for each one of these kinds of conflicts that you're referring to. It would be very helpful if you don't want to put the black representative to person, I mean, they just focus it over simplification. But at some point, when you send in a security force or a uniform force, there needs to be some direction to the humanitarian community and the political community about this cycle, because military forces are never neutral. They're always being supporting the underdog, and if they are working for government force, it's quite different than if they are working to support a group which is anti-government. What if they come from an increase, then provide horrible problems between the Department of State and the Department of Defense? But then also for the young men and women that stand in, they're never quite sure who the enemy is, or what the enemy is, whether or not it's the humanitarian economy, whether or not it's the population group, or the police or the census. And it seems like you have enough experience to be pretty directly on that.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. And we'll let you respond.
Well, I think this is easy because I think it was very much comments. I mean, with you, Dan, I agree. Benefits, I mentioned it, as you say, in passing. But as I start researching, and I'm just doing this chapter by chapter, so right now I'm writing the Forgotten Places, but in 3-4 weeks I will get into migration, which I, by the way, asylum, which I think will be the most difficult chapter, because it's huge, and I have to focus, and the most difficult will be the final conclusions, but still. But I will very much, because I want, this is one of my ways of responding to what I refer to as the right-wing political movements, which have been very successful in Europe, because they have focused exclusively on the negative sides. They have not so much been on the substance of these issues, but simply applied a tone, a language, which has been very negative and damaging for these societies. I would like focusing very much on the benefits, also because I agree that it is also very important to look at that, as you say, in relation to what you call the staggering costs on sort of ad hoc interventions here and there. So it will be, but I cannot go much further today than say I agree very much, but I can talk about it in the general terms, but I don't think that would interest anybody until I have spoken to quite a few people on these issues and looked at my ton of material that I already have on that. Patricia, when I talk about my concern about blurring distinctions, I should have mentioned at the same time I find it very, very important that we go into operations in a very integrated way, that we have the political, when we need the military to provide a secure environment or whatever, or to secure humanitarian staff, civilian staff, or whatever, that we go in an integrated, the humanitarian, the military, development actors and all that. So I am very much in favor of integrated missions. But I would say at the same time, the more integrated they become, the more important it is that each actor understands the distinct responsibilities of the various, let me call it, components of that integrated action. And that you don't have the humanitarian becoming development and the military becoming humanitarian, etc., etc. So I will be focusing a lot on that. So I'm worrying about the blurring of distinctions, which is very often deliberate, but at the same time, I believe we need much more of these, what I call coherent, integrated actions. But it is exactly because I believe we need more of that, that I'm very much focused on then respecting the distinctions. And I will not be looking at the mandates. Not that it's not interesting, but if that would have any interest, I'd rather write an article about that. But in the kind of book that I do, I also have to, my publisher also has told me very clearly sort of what are the number of pages, because that kind of subject, the publisher knows exactly how many copies they can sell. And that's helpful, by the way, because it helps with my discipline. I know exactly how many pages I have to produce, more or less. So I will not be looking at that. Not that it is not important, but it doesn't fall into sort of the kind of book that I've been asked to write or I'm writing. And then just say humanitarian action certainly very often can also have political consequences. And that I will also focus on. On the military force guidance, if I can just make one comment on that now. What I find particularly important, I think what you are suggesting is very important and I've taken note of it, but let me rather use sort of this opportunity to say it is very important for humanitarian organizations to maintain a strict impartiality. In other words, not on which side you are on. as a humanitarian organization, you must be on all sides. That is, unfortunately, very often dealing with the devil, or but you cannot. I mean, you act as a humanitarian on the basis of needs. What you cannot, however, as a humanitarian, you cannot, in my view, remain neutral. There may be colleagues here from the humanitarian field who will now walk out and leave. When I say, but I find it very difficult to be neutral as a humanitarian organization, in the face of atrocities as you see them, in the face of what we saw, for example, in the conflicts in the former Yugoslavia, we wanted this to stop. So we were not neutral in the sense that we saw and we were direct witnesses to the consequences, and therefore we desperately wanted that conflict to stop. And we had no problems in telling the political bodies, stop it. And when they would then use the humanitarian action as a pretext for not moving in, the first 3-4 years, the key states in Europe and here would say, no, we cannot intervene militarily because that would disrupt the humanitarian operation. We would tell them, please don't use us as a pretext for not doing what you should do, because this suffering has to be stopped. And if you decide to move in militarily, all we ask for is 24 hours notice so that we can get out of the way. So I think this whole issue of impartiality and neutrality is important. But you will never find a humanitarian organization giving guidance in saying which side you should be on, because you can't. But I've taken note of your point. I'll reflect on it further. I rather use the opportunity to explain a little bit how I look at these concepts. For me, these are not just words. These are realities.
Okay. Thank you. Now, the subject of impartiality, I saw a couple hands on this side of the room, but I think I want to give this side preference so I don't favor my own side. Let's start with Carola, this gentleman, and this lady in the back.
Sorry, thank you very much for interesting and thought-provoking presentation. I wonder if I could push you on two points a little bit further. Carola Vile with USIP grant program. The first is on this question of selectivity and also the forgotten crisis, if I might link those two a little bit. What seems to be happening to some extent is that as we have this new rhetoric of the responsibility to protect, it is raising expectations of protection that cannot necessarily be met. And so part of the question with regard to selectivity is, since we obviously can't be everywhere at all times, how do we in fact, what are your thoughts on how do you in fact implement a responsibility to protect? That's the first point. The other point is, you mentioned early on that you thought it was very important to bring out the European perspective, and I agree with you on that, but I wonder if you could say a little bit more about, do you think that the soft power approach works better than a hard power approach? Are they completely integral to each other? Can they not be separated? When you typically speak to European representatives on these issues, they will always say, well, our way is better than the American way. And Americans tend to point to results and say, well, but we're more effective than the Europeans. So where do you come down on these issues?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Tristan Hoffman, UC Davis alumni. I'd hate to bring this up on UN peace debate, but I'm curious if you feel the UN still has a legitimacy in peace began. Referring to the allegations of Pakistan selling weapons for gold in the Congo. There's certainly been a lot of other scandals. And if not, do you feel there's any other organization which could take over peacekeeping operations, whether that be NATO, the EU, or private security?
Okay, thank you. Finally.
Thank you. Before I mention on the weapons device, something that's not even spoken about
I have two comments. Suggestion for maybe what you can look in your research. First of all, would be where do you see that doctrine, the responsibility, things like that? Where do you see God going? Because in essence, it's very, very different from the concept of humanitarian intervention. It's faith in sovereignty, or the other terms, in renewed sovereignty. And secondly, something else, for basically on the point of UN legitimacy and also military forces of a country always being sort of partial and not really neutral, there has been a solution sort of circulating in the public sphere. How about bringing private security military to IDP camps in Darfur? Because they're cost effective, they can be deployed in a week, they're neutral, they're there to do a job. So, how do you see that, especially from the
engagement
perspective?
Okay, thank you. Okay. Yeah. Okay. We need to get you a note taker to keep track of all these great
That's
questions
fine.
And comments.
That's fine. Yes, on the selectivity and how to apply the responsibility to protect. First of all, I fully agree with you, Carola. Of course, we cannot intervene in each of the crises. As a humanitarian, I would wish that were so, but we can't, and I know that. I don't know yet, and I may not know by the time I sit down and write the concluding chapter, but it is something that I will focus on because I'm struck with it. If you are lucky, maybe it's because you are in Europe, like Kosovo or Boston and all that, you benefit from a humanitarian intervention. Other situations, you don't, and most of them, you don't. I hope that the very fact that the UN and the Security Council have at least established a responsibility to protect could raise the attention. In other words, there's a chance that more issues will be brought at least on the agenda and then voted down, as we have seen, because the will not be there. But I also believe that this responsibility to protect, although I don't know whether this can be proven or what, it is very much because of the pressure that is increasingly emerging from civil society organizations, the public and the media and all that. And as we see the force and the power and the influence of civil society growing, which I believe it is, more and more of these issues will be, as I say, brought to the attention. And at least they have to deal with it. And then, as we have seen, I mean, responsibility to protect, how has that affected Darfur? Not at all. So, I don't have an answer, but I think it is very, very important. And that is why I have decided to have just four forgotten crises, because I want, they're all different, as you can, Afghanistan before 9/11, Burma, Colombia, and Western Sahara. But I hope by looking just briefly at those four, that I can build up some evidence and then also some suggestions. As to the European, that's maybe easier to answer. I saw that Carl Bildt, the Swedish foreign minister, was in town the other day and said something to the effect that what we need is a little bit more hard soft power and a little bit more soft hard power. That's not exactly what he said. Carl is very good at sort of phrasing, but that's what he said. And I think that's correct. A little harder European and at times a little softer US. But all I can say based on my experience in the Balkans, it has worked very well. I mean, we would never have been where we are today if it hadn't been for the US hard power, which is still what they appreciate and respect in the region. You go out, and I'm sorry to say as a European, if they were to vote, including in Kosovo, they would vote for, first for the U.S. and second for Europe. They know that their future is in Europe. But so I think that it's worthwhile reflecting on it at a time where the U.S.-Europe relations have gone through some very difficult moments. On the ground in Western Balkans, it has worked very well and is still working very well. When I was in Macedonia as the EU representative, my closest collaborator was the U.S. ambassador. He would go and threaten his way, and I would go and threaten with the carrot and stick, which is EU integration. But my threats would be very ineffective if they were not combined with, it's not all threats, it's also promises, but the U.S. Weight there. So I believe that I agree with what apparently Carl Bill said. I think the Europeans have to find a way of not just hiding behind their so-called soft power. And on the other hand, a little bit more softness in approach from time to time on the U.S. side. But that's a very general statement that we can't really use. But looking at the our experience in the Balkans and how it has worked, and worked very well. When I talked about the EU perspective, it is of course for the countries in the region. There is no issue that is as important. That is for Europe to stand firm by the commitment they have given to the countries in that region that their future is in Europe. If there is any doubt about that commitment, then we have a problem. The whole reform process has been driven by that perspective. And I just hope, I don't see any signs that they are wavering. I think they all understand that it is the EU perspective that is driving the reform process in the Western Balkans. And I saw it both when I was in Macedonia, but also Kosovo, how important that carrot and stick is. On the peacekeeping legitimacy, let me just say, I mean, first of all, it is regrettable. I find it more than regrettable. It makes me very angry when I see peacekeepers being involved in or being accused for being involved in the kind of things you refer to. But at the same time, let us also recognize that how regrettable and how serious it is, we are still talking about a few rotten apples. And I don't think it should detract from the very important role that UN peacekeeping has been playing and still playing and doing great, great jobs in many, many places. And I know from my time when I reported directly to the peacekeeping department that the Undersecretary General Gehenu and the United Nations take that extremely seriously. When I was in Kosovo, we had the visit of the Deputy Secretary General at the time, Louise Frechette, because she was traveling around to a lot of peacekeeping operations on the sexual abuse that some peacekeepers were guilty of or suspected of. And she came to Kosovo just to make sure that there was nothing of that sort going on. Not that she just, since it is an important peacekeeping operation, and I'm very pleased to say, I think that we were on top of that. And I know that all leaders of a peacekeeping operation, they take it extremely seriously, as do, because we know that even one rotten apple can discredit the entire UN and peacekeeping in particular. Are there other alternatives? Yes, not because we can live without peacekeeping. I still believe that the UN peacekeeping has a very important role. But it is, as I mentioned earlier, very important that we strengthen the regional alternatives. Because having the regional organizations on the ground, knowing the local environment, is of course very important. I would say at the same time, that also poses a problem. Because very often, as we saw it in West Africa, the regional organizations are not neutral. I would use the word neutral here. And therefore, it is not in all situations that you can use. But when they are there, they need to be used, but above all, supported, given the resources and the capacities. and I don't think we're improving on that. And the responsibility to protect, where is that going? I don't know. I really don't know, because it hasn't gone anywhere. Yes, since it was adopted, we have been faced with the crisis in Sudan, and it has not been applied. There is still a lot of discussion going on, as you know. Is this a legal norm? Is it just a political concept? What are the responsibilities flowing from that responsibility? But as I said earlier, I do hope and I do believe the very fact that there is now focus on that will eventually bring it up on the agenda and will eventually put more pressure to bear on the members of the Security Council. They cannot continue ignoring a responsibility, because I think it is already, if not agreed, it is clearly understood that the responsibility to protect is a responsibility for the Security Council. This is not a carte blanche for any coalition of the willing, just to say we have a responsibility to protect. I think it is extremely important that this be considered as the, I think I will always say, the exclusive responsibility of the United Nations Security Council, which again poses all kinds of problems, as we know, because what do we do when there are members of the Security Council which do not see a responsibility to protect? Again, Darfur and Sudan is the best example. So I think these are still early days, but like many people, I believe the very fact that there is a General Assembly now and a Security Council recognition of that is very important. And I think Kofi Annan was very right in raising this as one of his most important achievements. Oh, private security, sorry, it was on the next page. there I'm afraid that I would be a little bit more cautious. I have also been dealing with them. I would not agree that they are cost effective. They are damned expensive. Damned expensive. I remember when we were struggling in Rwanda, Zaire, when we had the mixed camps in Zaire. We wanted a peacekeeping operation to go in and separate the killers, the genocidaires, from the civilians. And the UN looked into it after 5-6 months, decided that there were no takers. There were no member states prepared to embark on what would have been a very dangerous mission. Then the secretariat, I should not mention who, sent over to me the chief of one of the leading private security companies. And they came with a concept, with a plan of operations and a deal. I think it would have worked. But then the costs, they were prohibitive. The costs were 1/4 of the global UNHCR budget at the time. The UNHCR budget at the time was about $1 billion. The cost of that one single operation was $250 million. Then you can say, oh, I mean, that would still have been cost effective because tackling that problem. But I think you very often find that certainly for humanitarian organizations, when they need the kind of security, the costs would be prohibitive. A second problem, but you should look at the results, but I still would argue that there will always be a problem of transparency. The transparency of those kind of operations. But If it was not so damned expensive, as I have found it on a couple of occasions, I would say in the interest of tackling a major problem where there are nobody else prepared to do it, one should look at it.
Okay, thank you. Let's start with this gentleman over here, Taylor in the back, and do we have a third question? Okay, well, let's start with you.
David Scotton, I'll have my United Nations Association hat on this afternoon, sorry. I'm a former UN executive as well. In fact, that's where I first met Soren in Geneva. I notice a common thread throughout your presentation, chapter by chapter, and that thread is the failure of the Security Council to act, either in a timely way, to act at all, or to act in a way that just doesn't really address the problem, solve the problem. In the Western Balkans, you mentioned it in that chapter, in the chapter on Africa and the Great Lakes region, the failure to address the genocide until it was too late. In the forgotten crises in Afghanistan, Burma, Colombia, Western Sahara, the failure of Security Council again to act, and then in many instances with the migration issues, the failure of the Security Council to act. And that leads me to suggest that the Security Council, let's face it, is run by the Permanent Five. And there are geopolitical interests on the part of the Permanent Five. For example, China is very much engaged in the Burma issue. And if it hadn't been for China, probably would have been well on its way to resolution if it hadn't been resolved by now. Also, China in all other Southeast Asia issues as they come up. Russia and Kosovo, as we know, and is heating up as of yesterday's conversation between Putin and Bush. But also in East Europe, and now saying that Ukraine and Georgia should not be ascend in to NATO. The U.S. With Mexico and Latin America and the huge immigration issue and the wall that you mentioned, the U.K. In the Middle East, France in North Africa, Western Sahara, Sudan. So the comment, and you started to address it in response to the question from the person behind me. The question I have is, do you see the Security Council becoming more engaged? Do you see the Security Council, and this is a biggie, being redefined anytime soon? Because if the Security Council is the problem and the Permanent Five is running the Security Council, basically, what would you see as a possible solution? And are you going to address this in your final chapter?
Okay, I might even be tempted to suggest the reason the Security Council has the responsibility to have is because it won't do it.
That's the way to be with that.
Okay, thank you. Taylor?
Hi, Taylor, from both the USIP. It's close to the beginning of this, but if you get like the term humanitarian intervention, I just published a book with the title of the life in the class, which is humanitarian military intervention.
No, because that is partly right.
Well, I hope it's partly right.
Yeah.
That's the idea. I want to come back to the question of humanitarian action and political action and the lines between them, whether or not humanitarianism is in fact political. And I would submit to you that it is fundamentally political. Where humanitarian action takes place is determined in part by political decisions. Certainly through military forces are sent in, through the UN forces or others. But even humanitarian organizations are constrained by their budget, and the budgets often become larger than states, and states give money to organizations to do work where they want them to do it. And where you go in is partly influenced by politics. You, in your comments, have said that humanitarian action can have political consequences, and I think that's certainly true. The other side of the coin is that military action, which is the sharp edge of politics, can have humanitarian consequences in itself. So in all those ways, humanitarian action is heavily influenced and also influences politics. For people on the ground, I would submit that there's also a very political dimension to humanitarian action. Humanitarian organizations bring in resources into war zones. Resources in war zones are incredibly valuable. People fight over them because they're fighting for power. They're fighting for power as a political action. So in what way is humanitarianism in any real sense not political? I understand the principles of humanitarianism. I think that they have some value. But let me just end by saying I think the existence of humanitarian organizations and actors, if they are non-political, is detrimental. That by not recognizing the political nature of humanitarian action, they often do things like move in together in the camps we don't want. And in fact, do war if not careful.
Okay, thank you. We have about 5 minutes left, so I just wonder if you could try the best you can to answer those and give us any concluding comments.
It's good we only have two, because both of them are subjects of a book, maybe not mine. That very briefly, on David's, no, I don't think I will get into any details on whether the Security Council is right to be redefined. So many books have been written and papers and all that, so I will only sort of mention it in reference. I don't think I'm the one who can contribute to that. However, I will evidently be trying to draw some conclusions. And again, it's based on experience. I spent 4 years in New York as the UNHCR director there, and these were the years where Rwanda and Bosnia were on the agenda every day, and I would spend most of my time in that job dealing with the Security Council, and I came away very frustrated from that, but at the same time fully realistic. I hope I'm not that naive, even if I'm Scandinavian. I'll be looking for the same reason at the failure of the Council to act only on the Western Balkans, and on the two African situations, West Africa and Rwanda. When we move into the forgotten crisis, those I am looking at, and the migration, I think that goes way beyond the Security Council. And I will be looking at other sort of parts of the so-called international community, but again, the political bodies. Not that I will not also look at the Security Council. And we all know the problems are exactly as you described them. Do you see the Security Council becoming more engaged? I think that more and more issues will land on the agenda, but I don't think they'll lead to more decisions. Whenever there is no will on the part of one of the permanent five, as we all know, and you mentioned it. But I do hope, and I think, by the way, when I introduced this subject, I did it as a question. I said, so what do we do? Is there a way of holding them accountable, I said. But it was a question. And I realized there is not a way of holding them. So again, I see the only hope coming from an increasingly active civil society and the media reminding the Council of its responsibilities. By that pressure, hopefully pushing some action. I don't know whether, but there is a lot of pressure right now on the Sudan and on China. Will it work? I don't know. I would certainly not be looking at reform and all that. In my view, this whole reform issue, as needed as it is, as timely, as urgent as it is, at the same time, it is a wonderful cliche from those who want to put pressure on Secretary General and others. We need to reform the UN. But where we really need to reform the UN is in the Security Council. But we know that we will get nowhere, because there will simply never be agreement. We have so and so many permanent rotational bases. I mean, we have followed the debates. So I must say I'm not very hopeful. So I will not focus exclusively on the failure of the Security Council. First of all, I don't think the Security Council, unfortunately, is that important in that sense, and there are other actors as well. But I will, in those clear instances where the Security Council had the information and failed to act, I will be looking at that, because I saw on the ground the very dramatic humanitarian consequences, and I thought it was almost criminal failure to act. But what do you do with that thing? This is a key issue, and I cannot. Let me just say that it is extremely important that the humanitarian organizations try to stay non-political. But they all know, we all know that we are operating in a political environment. We all know that there are consequences of what we do or what we don't do, etc. But that is exactly, in my view, why it is important to remain non-political. I think you have, if you look at the humanitarian spectrum, you have the ICRC, which is still doing its utmost to remain non-political and quite successful. A lot will criticize them for that, quite successful. On the other side of the spectrum, you have organizations such as the Médecins Sans Frontières, which have taken a deliberate decision that you cannot be non-political. You have to call the politics. And then, somewhere in between, you have a lot of the others, I believe, including UNHCR. My concern is, as I said earlier, exactly because of that reality, the humanitarian organizations have lost, either by their own fault or by the fault of others, have lost their integrity and have lost their voice. I am, of course, also very concerned. At the same time, it is becoming increasingly dangerous to be a humanitarian staff. Like a lot of you, I have lost a lot of friends because the humanitarians are more and more seen as the extended arm of the political and military operations and therefore not impartial, and because of the resources and others, are the easiest and the most direct targets of attacks and all that. I think that is not only a danger to the staff of the humanitarian organization, but I do still believe it is a threat to the integrity of humanitarian action. I'm aware of the real world we live in, but I don't think there's any harm in trying to continue focusing on the importance of the humanitarians, to try to stay humanitarian, not naive or whatever, understanding the political environment and all that, and at the same time that political bodies and military institutions do not, by their actions, make it even more difficult for the humanitarian organizations to remain humanitarian. I think it is a major dilemma for the humanitarian organizations today. I may sound very sentimental, and maybe I am, but I think it is important to preserve humanitarian action as one of the most noble, important things we can do in life.
Okay. What a wonderful thought to end on. Soren, I'd like to thank you for a really interesting presentation. I'd like to thank everyone for coming, and we hope to see you at future project reports. Thank
and
you.
And if
again.
I can just thank one person, mm-hmm. I have looked around, she's not here. That is Elizabeth Jones.
Oh, she's waiting. Hi,
Elizabeth.
The map.
Yeah. Oh, I'm
yes.
glad.
Soren,
I want to thank
sorry.
Elizabeth very much, who is extremely helpful to me on research and other issues, and has also been helpful in putting this arrangement together. Thank you very much, Elizabeth.
Okay, thank you.